They took the crime scene DNA evidence, which didn't match me, and put it in the DNA data bank. And it matched.
And it hit.
It hit. It matched the actual perpetrator whose DNA was in that data bank because left free while I was doing time for his crime. He killed a second victim just 3.5 years later who was a school teacher and had 2 children.
The very thing we talked about happening happened, which is by railroading you, they ignored that there was a murder on the loose and he did it again. Oh, my goodness.
So on September 20th, 2006, the convictions overturned. I was released. I went back to court November 2nd, 2006, at which point all the charges were dismissed against me on actual innocence grounds. And he was subsequently arrested and convicted of the crime.
Welcome to an army of normal folks. I'm Bill Courtney. I'm a normal guy. I'm a husband, a father, I'm an entrepreneur, and I've been a football coach in inner city Memphis. And the last part, it accidentally led to an Oscar for the film about our football team. It's called Undefeated. Guys, I believe our country's problems will never be solved by a bunch of fancy people in nice suits using big words that nobody ever uses on CNN and Fox, but rather by an army of normal folks, us. Just you and me deciding, hey, I can help. That's what Jeff Deskovic, the voice we just heard, has done. At 16 years old, Jeff was wrongfully convicted of raping and murdering a classmate, despite overwhelming evidence that he was innocent. And after serving 16 years for crime that he did not commit, Jeff was finally exonerated. And rather than being dominated by anger or, as he puts it, victimhood, that no one would have blamed him for at all, he went to work. Fight him for the freedom of others who've been wrongfully convicted. He has already freed 11 people. I cannot wait for you to meet Jeff right after these brief messages from our generous sponsors.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my 3 young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery. But that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which is morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
J. Jeff Deskovic from the Bronx, all the way from New York, down here to Memphis. How are you?
I'm great. Glad to be here.
How was the flight in?
Scary. I thought I was going to die on it. The plane, like for about what seemed to me to be 10 minutes is, you know, up and down movement on the plane. And, you know, I thought it was close for 10 minutes and I thought I was going to die. My stomach got upset. Then I felt too hot, so I turned on double air, you know, for me and the passenger next to me. And that helped the warming part, but then I quickly got cold. So it was short of fatality. This was like the airplane trip from hell.
We were 76 degrees yesterday, and we're going to be 33 today. So I guess the high-low pressure systems probably created a lot of turbulence on the way down from New York, and you were the beneficiary of all that. Well, thanks for making it.
Absolutely.
You didn't have to use a little bag in front of you,
No,
did you?
Thank God it didn't thank come God to that. Come to although that. I felt I wasn't that far away from it either, though, just to be clear.
Don't know if you paid any attention while you were getting over your green gills coming into the Crosstown Concourse, but you're in the Memphis Listening Lab, which is a cool thing that goes back to, as you know, I assume you know, Memphis is Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and a lot of rich Memphis heritage music. And Memphis Listening Lab is where we're recording from, and kind of cool digs, isn't it?
It really, really is. I'm a historian, and I'm also nostalgic, so I'm kind of in awe right now.
That's cool. The what you walked in, this was the Southeast Region Sears Tower, and it was when Sears went down, it became empty, and this place was dilapidated and completely empty, and homeless people living in it only 10 years ago.
Wow.
And this whole area around it was suffering. And some investors in Memphis came together, refurbished and repurposed this entire building. And Memphis Listening Lab is only one of 1,000 tenants in this massive building. That there's a school here, there's a grocery store here, restaurant, businesses, all kinds of things. So kind of a cool revitalization project. And one of the places is this Memphis Listening Lab. So anyway, welcome to Memphis. I'm glad you get to see a little bit of our history.
Thank you very much.
Your story's amazing, and it really starts when you're 16. But just quickly, how'd you grow up? Did you grow up in the Bronx?
No, I grew up in Peekskill in Westchester County. I grew up in an apartment complex known as Crossroads. I would describe Peekskill as a middle-class, ethnically diverse city with a population of approximately 25,000 people.
How far is that, you know, geographically, so I can picture it on the map from, like, New York, Manhattan?
1 hour. Peekskill is 1 hour north of Manhattan.
Okay.
It's suburbia.
Middle-class suburbia.
Correct.
Got it. Now what'd your mom and dad do for a living?
Yeah, my mother was a typist. My father was actually never in my life in any aspect. Before I was even born, he wanted out of financial responsibility, so he denied that I was his. So I grew up really with my mother, my grandmother serving, who lived with us, served kind of like the second parent. But she was, in a way, a combination of both dad and mom. So she was mom because mom was the breadwinner, so grandma stayed home to care. But grandma was also like the father in the sense that she was the disciplinarian who kept me and my brother, who's 3.5 years younger than me, in line.
Got it. I think many of us have had grandmothers like that. And in the South in particular, mm-hmm. those grandmothers are not to be trifled with.
Exactly. Yeah. Neither was mine back north, so I can relate.
I got it. And so I guess you went to public high school and public schools?
Well, I went to Catholic school from grades 2 through 8. The Peekskill High School, which was public, actually literally was across the street from the apartment complex that I grew up in, and hence my deciding to go there rather than the – my mother wanted me to go to Catholic high school, but they had like the high school version of an entrance exam.
Yeah.
And, you know, being smarter than my parent, not.
Yeah.
I decided to purposely flunk the entrance exam so that I could go to the public high school. And as the story will unfold, I mean, that really kind of shaped my life and everything that happened after that. So of course, I had no way of knowing that.
You purposely tanked the test because you wanted to go to public school, not Catholic school.
Correct. Yes.
Well, kids will do what kids do, right?
That's right.
If your grandmother had found that, she'd have probably whooped your butt.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Okay. So until you're 16, mm-hmm. I guess at 16, are you a junior in high school?
Well, I would have been. So, I wanted to go to public high school, not just because of the geographic locale, but in the apartment complex where I grew up at, there were a lot of kids that lived in the buildings and in the surrounding areas. I was kind of like one of the main kids, so that whatever I suggested would generally be what I would do for what we're going to do. We're going to play basketball, stickball, Monopoly, where it's movie night, you know, whatever, or half dozen games we made up. And we even played tackle football without pads on the grass. But whatever I would suggest would generally be what we all did. But that was my life after school. My life in high school, I thought that I was going to be mixed in with those kids since they all went to public school and not the Catholic grade school. But actually, they were not. They were kids that were 1 or 2 years older than me. I had skipped first grade, and that kind of caught up with me in going to high school. So everybody was like older than me. So I didn't quite fit in. I was kind of like on the fringes of the society. And so that my first year as a freshman, really, I was kind of picked on in school. And so my grades suffered a lot. And it came to the point that I had to go to summer school to do two classes in order to pass. But I knew that if I did, then I would be in with these same kids again. And so I didn't go to summer school. I got left back. So I repeated freshman year. So at 16 years old, I was a sophomore, not the junior that you correctly point out mathematically I should have been.
Okay. So what were you into in high school, your freshman and sophomore year?
Yeah, I mean, I played basketball. I liked video games. I was kind of an athlete, but not in the school, not in organized sports, not with the kids there. It was after school. I was into all those games that we used, you know, I loved playing kickball, for example. I liked playing basketball. I lived in the swimming pool. We had a 12-foot pool with a diving board in it. You know, so that was available in the summer. I would describe myself as pretty athletic, pretty energetic.
So
after school.
So what you're describing is a kid.
Correct.
Just a kid.
Exactly.
From a middle class neighborhood.
Yes.
No affluence whatsoever.
None whatsoever.
But you had food on the table.
Correct.
You had a mother and a grandmother that cared for you, loved you, and disciplined you, and kept you straight as they could.
Yes.
You weren't in a whole lot of trouble.
Absolutely not. No.
Did you do any drugs?
Never. Not a day in my life. Not even now as an adult.
Did you ever get picked up for shoplifting?
Not even.
Nothing.
Nothing.
You're just a blue collar New York kid.
Yes, exactly.
Nothing really remarkable and nothing really, you're just a normal folk.
Exactly. Yes, it's true.
And then your life changed.
And then my life changed.
So on November 15th of 1989, your classmate, Angela Correa?
Correa
was murdered.
Yes, she was.
And they found her strangled and raped, I believe?
Yes, they did, 2 days later on November 17th.
How did that affect the school? And a community of only 25,000 people.
It rocked the community because murders were very rare. There were periodic town hall meetings where safety tips and progress on investigation were held. Many people, you know, there were four sessions of wake. Many people attended three or four of them. It impacted everybody so much to the point that free mental health counseling was offered to everybody in Peekskill who wished to avail themselves of it.
Do you remember her family?
I do. I met the family afterwards. So I went to wake sessions. I went to the funeral, the cemetery, and there was an announcement made at the cemetery grounds that anybody that wished to come back to the Correa home, have coffee, there would be some cookies and talk to the family, was free to do so. And so I availed myself of that. And so I met the family, but that was afterwards. They seemed like a really tight, warm, close-knit family. There was a stepfather in the home, which was a new thing, just the idea of living with an adult male. And it all seemed to like work and click, and it was something foreign to me somewhat, because again, I didn't have a father in the household.
And it was sad.
It was very sad. Yes, it was. And I was a sensitive teenager, and you know, this did affect me emotionally. This was my first real brush with death, and I did have an emotional reaction to that. That's important in the unfolding of the story, because it was one of the factors that put me on the police radar. So the police interviewed many students from the high school, and some of them told the police they might want to talk with me because I didn't quite fit in. I guess the theory in their head was people that are quiet to themselves are more likely to commit a heinous crime. So I was suggested to the police to look at for that reason. And secondarily, the police thought that, you know, given my actual relationship with the victim, which is to say really no relationship, she was in two of my classes as a freshman, one as a sophomore. I knew her name. She knew mine. The police interpreted my being emotional as some sort of outward sign that I was sorry for what I had done. So those two factors put me on the police radar. And that was buttressed by a psychological profile that the Peekskill Police obtained from the NYPD, which purported to have the psychological characteristics of the actual perpetrator. And I had the misfortune of matching that.
What was that?
Somebody that was knew the victim, that was in high school, and that was a loner. Well, congrats, you really narrowed that down quite a bit, right?
I can't believe I'm laughing, but
no, it's okay. We do dark humor and we laugh at stupidity and other stuff. So that's what got me on the police radar. And so for about 6 weeks, the police play this cat and mouse game with me, in which half the time they would talk to me like I'm a suspect. And when they would push too hard and I'd become frightened and I'd want to get away from them, they would switch up the conversation. And Jeff is this junior detective helper theme was developed. Somehow or another, they learned that prior to being a teenager, the career that I dreamed about having was to be a cop. So they would say things like, well, the kids won't talk freely around us, but they will around you. Let us know if you hear anything. Stop in from time to time. They would ask me opinion questions and congratulate me that my opinion was correct. They made me feel important. They did the good cop, bad cop routine, and that intersected with growing up without a father or stepfather in the household. I began to look up to the cop who was pretending to be my friend as a father figure.
And thusly, you trusted him.
And thusly, I trusted him.
So how long did this cat and mouse game go on?
6 weeks.
So 6 weeks after this girl's rape and murder, they had solved nothing.
Right.
And I got to believe in a town of 25,000 with grief counselors and a very rare murder and everything else, there was enormous amount of pressure on the police to figure out who did this thing.
Correct. And I want to add that beyond that general pressure, another element of that was that the Correa family didn't think the Peekskill Police knew what they were doing. And so they went to the state police and asked the state police to take over the investigation. The state police did not, but they let that be known to the Peekskill Police. So that ratcheted up the pressure to solve. And I want to add also, talking about how this impacted the community, Peekskill, for most intents and purposes, shut down. I mean, parents were driving their kids to school, picking them up right after school, you know, bringing them straight home. There was a general atmosphere of fear, rumor, and to some extent, paranoia in Peekskill.
Were you, your mom, and your grandmother scared?
A little bit, yes, we were. We were. My mother didn't want me to go out for a while, and if I was, then eventually when she let up a little bit and allowed us to go out, you know, I had to go out with my brother or with another one of my friends. She didn't want me to go outside or go anywhere by myself.
It's a bad time.
It was a very bad time, yeah.
During the 6 weeks of the cat and mouse, were you discussing these conversations with your mom and grandmother?
I was not. I knew that my mother didn't want me to talk or interact with the police. So I told her about—
Did she not trust them?
She did not trust them. I told my mother about my first encounter with the police. And then she made clear to me that she didn't want me to talk to them because she knew that they were asking me questions and then they wanted me to try to help them with the case. But then that they also were asking me questions that suggested that I was a suspect. So she didn't want me to have anything to do with them. But I was also 16 years old, and that's an age where many people, we start to think that, you know, we know everything, we know more than
our parents are stupid.
And our parents are stupid. And to my way of thinking, well, I don't understand what your concern is. They're telling me that they want me to help them solve the crime. I didn't do anything. What could possibly go wrong with my interacting or helping the police? So I hid that from them. And the Peekskill police also knew that my mother didn't want to have anything, me to have anything to do with them, but they, you know, facilitated that.
How is that legal for a police department to mess with a minor without their parent?
Well, I mean, you're at 16, you're considered to be an adult for purposes of waiving your rights and speaking to the police without a parental authorization.
Does that start at 16?
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
So eventually, I understand they said, you know, why don't you take a polygraph test and just go ahead and rid yourself of any suspicion?
Correct. Exactly right. And they also added that once, not only that, but that they had some new information that come into their file and they wanted to share that with me. And that
sounds like BS.
It was, of course, but I didn't realize that. So both of it, why don't you just rid yourself of the suspicion and also let us be able to share this extra info with you, and that's going to allow you to be more helpful to us.
Yeah, you're going to be a better junior cop when we share this with you.
Correct. So,
you go in to this polygraph test kind of thinking, I'm going to help out, and I'm going to go ahead and remove myself from the name, and that way I can really be good junior cop.
Exactly. Yes.
All fed to you by this father figure cop that you're beginning to trust.
Yes.
Having not had a father in your home as a child.
Exactly right.
All behind your mother and grandmother's back because they didn't trust them, and you didn't want to let your mom know what you're doing.
Yeah, you've got it all right.
What could go wrong?
Right.
And now, a few messages from our generous sponsors. But first, I hope you'll follow us on all your favorite social media channels, where we share more powerful content from the Army. Search for @ArmyOfNormalFolks on every channel. We'll be right back.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it.
Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell me about the day you took the polygraph.
So it was a school day, and rather than go to the high school, I went to the police station for the test. I expected the test to be at the police station because, number one, they kind of implied that, and number two, the rumor mill in Peekskill was that a few other people had been polygraphed at the police station. So I'm expecting it to be at the police station. I go there with one of my best friends because it's a school day. My mother and grandmother think I'm in school. They don't have a clue that anything's wrong. Therefore, there is no phone call or coming to my rescue or intervention. That's off the table because they don't know. When I got to the police station, the police lieutenant told my friend just to go home, get out of there. And
what was your friend going to do with you?
Well, I wanted him to go with me while I had this idea that he could sit next to me while I was being tested. That was
more 16-year-old thinking, but I get it. Yeah.
Right. So when they sent him off.
Do you think just hearing that, do you think somewhere in the deepest recesses of your mind, you were worried about getting set up, which is why you had your friend go with you?
Yeah, I was. That was true.
Without being maybe consciously cognizant of it?
Yes.
Why else would you have a friend go with you except that you had this tinge of fear?
Correct. Yeah, you're right. No one's ever brought that out before, but yes, you're right.
Well, just listening to you, that kind of...
Yeah, it's true. And so therefore, when the lieutenant told him, go ahead, get out of here, I briefly entertained the thought of not going ahead with things at all. But then I thought, well, the idea of being an even better junior detective cop.
Plus, if you say no, you probably think, well, that makes them suspicious of me.
Yes, that's true too. Yes.
So you go with this friend, and the cops tell your friend to beat it.
Yep.
And what's he going to say? They're the cops.
Exactly.
And now you're there.
Right.
You can't exactly beat it. I can already feel the grip of this happening. I'm putting myself in a 16. Well. I'm 55 years old, but I've got about the mentality of a 16-year-old, so I'm relating real well to all of this right now. But, I mean, I feel that.
So I learned quickly, well, in fact, the test is not going to be at the Peekskill Police Station.
Why?
Well, they're bringing me to the – well, I know the answer now, but I didn't at the time. But they told me, look, we're going to stop in at a diner and eat something, and – then I was going to be brought to the location for the polygraph. I realize now the reason for that is so the polygraphist was a Putnam County Sheriff's investigator named Daniel Stevens, but I didn't know he was a cop. He was dressed like a civilian. He never identified himself as law enforcement. He never read me my rights. In terms of transportation, the psychological intrigue continued, so they put me in the car by myself with the good cop. The bad cop and a lieutenant were in a different vehicle. So they're he reads me my rights again, but I don't understand them because I'm 16. And plus, you're telling me that I'm here to help you. So that, to the extent I could grasp anything at all, that was all completely out the window. So we get there. I just described the polygraphist. I'm not given anything to eat the entire time I'm there. There's no lawyer present. He gives me a 4-page brochure which explains how the polygraph works, but it has a lot of words in it that I don't understand. But I figure, well, I'm here to help the police. So what does it matter? Let's just get on with it.
Why did they drive you somewhere else?
To bring me into his hands. He carried out this procedure, which he testified to, was called GTC, get the confession. And, you know, he had a knack for getting confessions all over the place. And that was why they brought me to him.
So what was the polygraph like?
They put me in a small room, and first the polygraphist gives me countless cups of coffee.
Great. Get you amped up.
Correct. And then he wired me up.
Are you serious?
Yes.
A 16-year-old, a bunch of coffee?
Yes. No sooner would I finish one cup that he was up here pouring away, you want another one? And I think he gave me between 6 to 8 cups. It was a lot. Then he wires me to the machine, and then he launches into first, he pretends as he's turning the dials, I'm gonna fine-tune the machine into your body's biofeedback, right? He does that routine for about 5 minutes. And then the nature of the beast comes out, and he launches his third-degree tactic. So he invades my personal space. He raises his voice at me. He's asking me the same questions over and over again, you know, and it's really frightening. I mean, he's a mountain of a man. I'm 16, I'm 150 pounds. I'm not used to talking, much less interacting with an adult male, much less one who's carrying on in a ferocious manner like he is. And each hour that passes by with him doing this.
Each hour? How long were you there?
6.5 to 7 hours. And towards the end, I guess he had enough of my denials. And he said, what do you mean you didn't do it? You just told me through the polygraph test result that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm it. And when he said that to me, that ratcheted my fear up. And that's when he left the room, and the cop, pretending to be my friend, came in the room and said, look, they're going to harm you. I've been holding them off. I can't do that any longer.
They're going to harm you?
Yes.
In other words, they're going to beat you?
Well, harm is what it is. I mean, they're going to beat me. I don't know that it would be limited to that. I don't know how far they're going to go. I have no idea of where I'm at. No one else knows where I was at. I felt in fear of my life, and I felt intimidated. So I felt like everything was on the table in terms of that, you know? So, and then he says, just tell them what they want to hear. You can go home afterwards. You're not going to be arrested. So being young, naive, frightened, 16, I wasn't thinking the long term. I was just concerned with the safety in the moment. I was overwhelmed emotionally and psychologically. And so I made up and then on one hand, this possibility of harm, and on the other, this false life preserver that he threw me. And so I took the out which he offered, and I made up a story based on the information he gave me that day and that I received in the 6 weeks run up to everything. By the time it was all said and done, I had collapsed on the floor into a fetal position, crying uncontrollably. Obviously, I was arrested. You know, I was charged with the murder and rape. This whole thing was not audio taped. It's not videotaped. It's no signed confession. It's all just the cop's word. And that would be a crucial factor later on, because when the case went to trial, they left the threat and false promise out of their testimony.
And it's your word against theirs.
Right.
And who's going to believe a raping, murdering 16-year-old over a good old cop?
Right. So that's the arrest.
I've been in business since 2001, so 23 years. When I first started in business, I didn't have any money. I didn't come from anything. And so I started my business literally rounding up whatever little money I could and buying used equipment. Literally the first line, of chain, lumber comes down what's called a pull chain. And it's just big, heavy chain that lumber comes down that you pull boards off of. I literally drug out from behind, out of some weeds behind an old furniture plant in North Carolina and paid like $500 cash for it and brought it back to Memphis and put it together. I put my plant together those first 5-6 years with used equipment, whatever I could buy, and I needed a front-end loader. And they're expensive. I mean, a new one today is 130 grand. Back then, a really good, you know, 2 or 3 year old one was $75,000. I couldn't afford that. And this guy who was a truck driver said he had some used equipment that he was getting rid of. And he said he'd bring them down for me to look at on his flatbed. And it was this old backhoe. It was a Ford backhoe that didn't look like much. And he sold it to me for like $6,000. And that was a good deal. And I needed it, so I bought it. 6 months later, members of an FBI task force showed up at my office, unannounced, with guns on their hip and badges, and said, "We need to speak to you in private." And we went in and they said, "How long have you been trafficking stolen equipment?" And I said, "How long have I been doing what?" This truck driver apparently had been stealing equipment from used rental equipment places all over the United States. He would take loads to their destination, and then on the way back home to Tennessee, during the night, he would pull over to rental companies and steal stuff and put it on his truck. And he had a ton of stolen stuff out on some land somewhere, and then he would just sell it as used equipment to guys like me. And I was like, "What are you talking about, Trav? I don't even know what you're talking about." And I didn't know that this guy, I didn't know. And they showed the VIN number, and sure enough, it was stolen from somebody in Alabama. And this guy had been selling used equipment all over the place. And everybody that had been buying it, me, you know, by the letter of law, broke the law because we were buying stolen equipment, but I wasn't trafficking in it. And once I finally convinced them, showed them the paperwork, I had a bill of sale and everything else, they switch gears immediately. And it's like, "Look, man, we see now that you're not trafficking in this stuff and you're not part of this ring, but you're out $6,500 because that's not yours and we've got to take it right now." And I said, "Better yet, I'll return it to the owner. I mean, I'll pay to have it freighted down," which is exactly what I did. The whole reason I'm telling this story is the hour that those men were in my office. Now, I'm a grown man at 38 years old, own my own business, and you know, I've been through a lot in my life. I remember trembling talking to those guys because it never really dawns on you until you're in the position. You're staring at a person that could take away your liberty. You're staring at a person that has all the power in the world to slap handcuffs on you, take you out of your home or your business, put you in a car, and throw you in jail. Whether they prove you've done anything or not, they have that ability, because if they have suspicion, they can do it, and it can upend your life. And I remember just in that situation how scared I was. I was frightened. I didn't know whether to call a lawyer. I didn't know who to talk to. I searched every word very carefully because I didn't want to misspeak. I didn't want to give these men any reason to doubt me. I knew I'd done nothing wrong. I didn't intend to buy somebody's stolen equipment. I trusted the guy that sold it to me. And it was terrifying. I cannot imagine what it must be like for a 16-year-old kid with no parent, no lawyer, no friends, for 6.5 hours being drilled by grown adults who you think are there to protect and serve you and trust. I'd imagine you'd have done anything to get out of that room.
Yeah, I would have.
And you did.
And I did.
We'll be right back.
Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun,
and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I didn't ever even actually realize I was under arrest until I got back to the police station. So when once they obtained this confession, I was crying uncontrollably. They finally calmed me down, and at that point they gave me something to eat, and it was time to go back and, you know, in the car, and, you know, they had rear cuffed me, you know, and I asked, well, why are you putting me in handcuffs? I was told that I wasn't going to be arrested. And the lieutenant just said, safety. And they put me in the car, and they drove me back to the police station. The good cop disappeared. Lieutenant disappeared. They said they were going to call ahead and order pizza at the police department. And so I'm eating pizza at the police department, and periodically I'm interrupted by a uniformed police officer that's carrying out different facets of the processing. And, you know, eventually he, you know, did the fingerprints and put the ink on the fingers, my fingers. And I remember being pretty angry at that point. And I saw the cop that his role had been like the bad cop. And I just said, you know, what is he doing? I've got ink on my fingers. I'm over here trying to eat pizza. And he said, well, oh, he has the right to do that. And I said, well, what do you mean he has the right to do that? I was told I wasn't going to be arrested. And he said, oh, you are being charged with a crime. And that was how I realized I was under arrest. So the police called my mother from there, and she came down to the police station.
How old was this girl?
15.
And she was raped.
And she was raped and murdered.
Okay. Ned and the First Reader, didn't they have DNA?
They did. They did. And so before I went to trial, the results of the DNA came in from the FBI lab, which showed that seminal fluid found in and around the victim didn't match me.
It did not match.
Did not match me. No. So to explain away the DNA, the prosecutor got this medical examiner to commit fraud and commit perjury. So when there's an autopsy done, they take the written and audio notes as they're making their findings. So it was only 6 months after doing the autopsy, hundreds of autopsies later, only after the DNA doesn't match me, does this medical examiner suddenly says, try to follow this now. He remembers that he forgot to document. He remembers that he forgot. This is such a heavy topic.
I feel like an ass for laughing.
It's okay. No, it's okay.
It's not okay.
But
he remembered that he forgot.
To document medical evidence, which
that is
he
almost
claimed,
like it depends on what the definition of is. It's the most ridiculous thing.
And he claimed he forgot to document that. So he's saying he found medical evidence to show the victim had been promiscuous, which was a lie. They made that up.
How can you find medical evidence that the victim had been promiscuous before she died when she was raped? That is stupid.
He claimed that on a slide, he saw a perforated hymen. So
she was raped.
Right. And that's what opened the door for the prosecutor to argue, aha, that's how the DNA doesn't match Deskovic, and yet he's guilty.
Oh, she insinuating that she had consensual sex before she was raped.
Correct.
This 15-year-old.
Correct. That was
so he's
story.
Throwing the victim under the bus, too.
Yes, he is. And then he is. And then he took it a step further and mentioned another youth by name that he claimed had slept with the victim. But he never had a DNA test performed to prove that. He didn't even call him as a witness to give verbal testimony. He just made the unsupported argument.
Why didn't the defense say, if that's who had sex, we're calling that witness and we're going to get a DNA test from them to disprove that?
Because of a conflict of interest.
What conflict of interest?
The other youth that the prosecutor was falsely saying had slept with the victim was represented by another member of that public defender office.
Oh, no.
And specifically by a lawyer that was supposed to be supervising him on my case. And so that conflict prevented the defense from asking him for a sample. It prevented the defense from calling him as a witness.
I got to say this to you. So far, hearing this story sounds like a non-affluent kid living in an apartment without a father or without the means to defend himself simply checking a box as someone to prosecute for this crime to get everybody off her. So we settled it.
I agree with that.
Socioeconomics has something to do with this too.
100%, because the lawyers that we spoke to wanted $50,000 as a retainer just to get started. There was no way.
Your grandmother and mother had to have been, well, first of all, wow, I'm going 90 different ways right now, but was a medical examiner proficient enough to establish a time of death?
Yeah.
Where were you during the time of death? You had to have just an alibi.
I did. I had one. I told my public defender I was playing wiffle ball with one of my friends at the time of the crime.
Okay.
And he never interviewed or called the person as my alibi. He never introduced the evidence to court.
Why?
I asked him that after I don't get too far ahead, but I asked him that after I lost the trial, and he said, "Oh well, I don't do cases like with a shotgun approach." You know, that was his answer, which didn't really make any sense. This lawyer essentially didn't defend me. So quickly, he rarely met with me. When he did meet with me, and I tried to explain to him that I was innocent and what happened in interrogation room, he was always shutting me up. One time, he told me he didn't care if I was guilty or innocent. He never explained to the jury the significance of the DNA not matching me. He never used that to argue that that proved that this confession was coerced and false. When it came time to cross-examine the medical examiner, my lawyer stood up in open court and with a big smile on his face, like they were friends from back in the day, said to him, "You're going to be pleased to know that I don't have a single question for you." He wouldn't allow me to testify either. He said that his personal one-loss record was significantly better when his clients didn't testify compared to when they did. That's probably true, but most of his clients probably have a record, and if they took the stand, they could be asked questions about that. But I had never been arrested for even a violation. And the other quick thing that he said to me was, and this is a very naive way to practice law, "It's not up to me to prove that you're innocent. It's up to the prosecution to prove that you're guilty, and I don't think they did that."
Did the judge not see the lack of defense and the inequity that was happening here?
I think that he did, because when I was found guilty and I was at the sentencing hearing, I begged him to overturn the verdict because I was innocent, and I referenced the DNA, and he said to me, "Maybe you are innocent." But instead of him overturning the conviction, he took the easy way out, which was to give me a 15-to-life sentence. I had been charged as an adult and sentenced as an adult and sent to an adult prison. So, first of all, polygraph test results are not admissible because it's not scientific, and you know it would be prejudicial for a jury to hear.
I'm a psychology major, and I will tell you that polygraphs are around 78% accurate. Mm. You can't take somebody's life away from them on 78%. They should be inadmissible. And if you happen to sweat a lot, they'll give false readings. And if you're nervous, they'll give false readings. And if you're cold-hearted and don't get nervous, you can also beat them on the other way. You can be trained to beat polygraph tests. There's a reason they're inadmissible. And one of them should be a scared shitless 16-year-old curled up in a fetal position has no business plugged up to a machine that's going to say whether or not he's lying, because it's going to register everything you're saying is lying.
So have you, having said that, the judge let the polygraphist repeatedly tell the jury that I failed the polygraph and that I lied when I denied committing the crime, while at the same time he prohibited my lawyer from asking him questions about the methods he used to arrive at his opinion. So you're right, the polygraph's inadmissible unless both sides agree. We didn't agree, but the judge created this backdoor rule. He said, "Well, this alleged confession took place while you were being polygraphed, so it's coming in that way." So that was an irregularity. And I got one that's arguably better than that. So the victim's clothes, including her bra, had been entered into evidence by the prosecutor. The jury asked to see the bra, and that was important because that was one of the statements that the cops coerced out of me, was I said that I ripped her bra off. So when the jury asked to see that, I mean, we thought they were thinking like we wanted them to think. There's some bras that you can't rip the way that they're made. And it was at that moment that the judge announced, he said, "Well, the bra and the rest of the victim's clothes had been left in the courtroom over the weekend, and apparently the janitors thought it was garbage. So it's been thrown out. It's not available anymore." And he substituted the bra with a photo in which he said, "You can almost see the bra in the photo."
Unbelievable. This is a kangaroo court.
The last thing is, on the third day of the jury deliberation, they sent out a note asking, "If we can't come up with a verdict, are we going to be kept sequestered over the Christmas holiday?" And the judge said yes. And I learned many years later, at that point, it was 11-1 for a conviction in the jury room. But there was a holdout juror that thought I was innocent, but they were all pressing him. And when they found out that they would be sequestered, nobody wanted to be sequestered, and he didn't either. So that ratcheted the pressure up, and then he switched his vote based on that. And I was found guilty of a murder and rape, which I didn't commit.
Have you spoken to that juror?
I haven't, but he spoke to my civil rights lawyers. He had saw on the news that I had been exonerated and released. And he said, well, I'm glad, because I never thought he was guilty. And so my lawyer asked him the obvious question, which, well, why did you vote that way?
And then he told you that story.
Correct.
And that concludes part one of my conversation with Jeff Deskovic. And you do not want to miss part two, that's now available to listen to. The redemption part, it's coming soon, and it will floor you. Together, guys, we can change this country, but it starts with you. I'll see you in part two.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.